Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
You're listening to the New Books Network, and this is the Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery Podcast. My name's Lucas Rickert, and welcome one and all. We're discussing psychedelics today, specifically mescaline. Let me introduce you to author Mike Jay. Mike is a public intellectual. He's the author of over a dozen books. He writes regularly for the London Review of Books, the Wall Street Journal, and the Literary Review. In addition to this, he works as a curator and exhibit designer for the Wellcome Trust in London. His most recent book is Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic, published by Yale University Press. Mike, it's wonderful to have you here, and I'm thrilled to talk about your book today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Luke.
Okay, so let's start off with you. Can you just give us a little sense of your background and how you got onto the topic of mescaline?
Yeah, my background, I guess, I'm not an academic. I did a degree in philosophy at Cambridge University, after which I decided I was kind of done with reading books. And I spent the next 10 years working in film and TV and journalism. And I've been pretty much a freelance writer ever since. I started writing about drugs quite early on, I guess 20 years ago in the sort of mid-90s, when nobody else was writing about it much and it became a kind of a specialism. At that time, people talked about drugs as if they had been invented by hippies in the 1960s. So I kind of, one of my sort of beats was to kind of try and show how, you know, our, you know, illicit drugs of today all have, you know, much longer histories than that, you know, and often very diverse and interesting histories. So that's been, you know, a subject area that I've written a lot about ever since.
And mescaline, and more specifically, what is it that's driven you towards this drug?
I've nibbled away at bits of mescaline's history in the past. It's a big subject to take on and a difficult one, but there were a couple of things that really appealed to me. One is that, I guess probably the story that most people know about mescaline is that Aldous Huxley took it in 1953, and he wrote his account of it in The Doors of Perception, after which he and the psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond, who'd given him the mescaline, coined the term psychedelic. So that's officially the beginning of the psychedelic era, and psychedelics are, we think of the story starting there in the sort of 50s and becoming a mass cultural phenomenon in the 60s. But what's interesting about mescaline is that that's more or less the end of mescaline's story. Mescaline kind of goes way back through different disciplines all the way through, you know, in the 20th century. And before that, it has a long varied indigenous history. So it's a chance to write about psychedelics, what they are, what they do, how they're used in different cultures through history. But outside this kind of, you know, contemporary sort of idea of what psychedelics are. So it's a way of, you know, taking something that we think we know and, you know, presenting it in unfamiliar contexts and making us think about it differently.
Cool. Well, let's pick up on that thread a little bit. You mentioned that it's been deeply ingrained in other cultures. And so can you tell listeners a little bit about its history beyond Western medical science?
Yeah. Mescaline occurs in nature in cacti, in two particular families of cacti. Very curious that it should be two very distantly related families of cacti. There's the San Pedro cactus, which is a tall, spiny, columnar, kind of classic cartoon cactus that grows all over the Andes, which contains about 1% of mescaline. And then there's the peyote cactus, probably more familiar, which grows in Mexico and a little bit of what's now Texas, which is a small, stubby little spineless cactus, which has a slightly higher concentration of mescaline. So there are two traditions of mescaline-containing cactus use, both of which are we have evidence for going back 4,000 or 5,000 years into prehistory. The San Pedro, for example, we see that carved on the walls of 3,000-year-old Peruvian temple up in the high Andes. But the first sort of Western engagement with mescaline-containing cacti is with peyote, which the Spanish encountered during the conquest of Mexico in the 16th century. So that we have a much longer, different kind of written history of.
Yeah, indeed. I remember reading some of Carlo Castaneda's work in undergraduate. That's. Mm-hmm. I guess the story of psychedelics more generally, I mean, whether or not it's mescaline or not, just to pick up on what you're talking about with other cultures, has been told, unfortunately, I suppose, through the lens of white middle-class men and Western-based science. So I guess, can you expand or tell us a little bit more about how, you know, other cultures have used mescaline, and then I suppose a little bit about the role of women as well in the history of mescaline medicine?
Sure. I mean, this is another thing that attracted me to the idea of writing a book about mescaline, is that mescaline kind of has two histories. You know, it was exactly 100 years ago in 1919, it was first synthesized in the laboratory. So for 100 years, it's existed in modern Western culture, in scientific and other contexts. And then it also has this non-Western indigenous history that goes back thousands of years. And it's interesting to write these two histories in parallel because the source material for them is so different. From the very beginning, which is the 1890s, when you get the first Western investigators, scientists and doctors taking peyote and writing about it, you get this literature that is very medico-scientific, at that point exclusively male, and which focuses very specifically on describing the effects of the presumed drug in this cactus, you know, before it's known exactly what it is. And this is a literature that we know quite well, and it's still, you know, this is still the way that, you know, most people in our culture write about drugs. If you go to something like the Erowid website, where people leave their reports, this is the kind of literature where people start, you know, 8:22 p.m. consumed, four buttons of peyote cactus, 9:15 p.m. start to notice the first sort of violet and green shimmerings around my, on my notepad and so on. It's a curious style, because on the one hand, it's very personal. On the other hand, it's kind of rather distanced and objective and scientific. So that's pretty much, we've got a very, very detailed literature of Western engagements with mescaline, and the vast majority of them have this style. So they have the central first person character in the middle narrating. And they're often very much focused on the sort of visual effects people get, you know, particularly from the very beginning with the masculine literature, people are trying to describe these kaleidoscopic patterns and bright colors that they're seeing on their, you know, on their closed eyelids. What's interesting when you then try and look back at indigenous histories is that, you know, you have very different type of source material. People very, very rarely give a first person account of what's going on because, you know, this is it's usually some kind of communal or collective experience. And there's quite a presumption against sharing your sort of personal and private visions in cultures like sort of the Huichol culture in Mexico. When anthropologists ask people, what do you see? What are your visions? People say, well, you know, why would I want to share that? That was something private that was given to me. What would be my motive for trying to impose that on other people? And in fact, there's quite often a presumption against the visions being interesting. There's an idea that if you're focused on the visions, you're being distracted. You're kind of missing the point. If there's a sort of collective ritual going on and all you're doing is sitting there with your eyes closed, you know, looking at these patterns on your eyelids, then, you know, you need to wake up and engage. So it's fascinating to tell these two stories in parallel and to see the different, you know, the specific assumptions that underlie our Western psychedelic paradigm.
So did this cause any problems with you putting the book together and trying to make these two overlapping, intersecting narratives work, or did it come together nicely?
I really enjoyed the two different forms of engagement. So my writing about the indigenous traditions is much more, you know, the mescaline-containing cacti are much more embedded in the culture and in the stories of the people. So you're writing something that is more like ethnography. You're telling the story of a whole people, and you're showing how, for example, the peyote ritual in the among the Plains Indians, you know, you're seeing who were the, you know, there are characters there, you know, community leaders, people who are advocates for this tradition and who spread it. But by and large, it's the story of the people and their situation. And then when you're looking at the Western mescaline, you're really looking at individual people's stories. And the interest of that, I think, I mean, it can often be when you're reading descriptions of people's drug experiences that you're just, it's like reading long descriptions of people's dreams. It's kind of boring. But if you have a sense of who the person is and why they're doing this and what they're looking for and what it means to them, then I think it becomes quite involving. So it was very nice to be able to transition between these collective cultural stories on the one hand and these individual personal stories on the other.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating elements of the book, at least as I read it, was how you highlighted certain cultural references. Sometimes they're pop culture, sometimes not. And I thought that many of them sort of just jumped off the page at me. And so basically the book's far from a story about medical science and regulation exclusively. Other authors are doing that. But I guess my question is, can you say a little bit about some of your favorite anecdotes, the cultural references or the cultural stories that really shone for you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one strand in the book is Western scientific engagement with mescaline. And there's a particular, I think it gives us a particularly interesting angle on the history of regulation, particularly looking at the, you know, the Plains Indian peyote religion and the Native American church as it became. But beyond that, there's an awful lot that spreads beyond that, because there's a lot of spiritual engagement, of course, and some of this is very surprising. You know, very early on during the 1900s and 1910s, I was astonished to discover, for example, that the Reformed Mormon Church, led by Frederick Smith, who was the grandson of Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon Church, that he was a kind of, I think like a lot of people at the beginning of the 20th century, he was kind of progressive minded, and he felt that Western culture was becoming mechanized and dull, and he believed that we really needed some kind of ecstatic religious experience in our lives. And the Mormons, of course, being where they were, reached out to a lot of Native American tribes. You know, that was an important part of their missionary work. And Frederick Smith attended peyote ceremonies and, you know, thought that this was, you know, an experience that connected him, you know, not just to centuries of spiritual tradition across the world, but particularly to, you know, his vision of Christ, you know, the perfected man. And so it was fascinating to discover that, you know, that people like that were interested in peyote. And around the same time, then you had other people engaging with it very differently. For example, Aleister Crowley, the famous occultist and magician at that time, was experimenting with it. And I was also interested to see how it kind of gives us very interesting stories of scientific engagement. There's persistently when people, whether they're psychologists or neuroscientists or psychiatrists, try and investigate it, they find that it kind of spills over from their discipline. So there are great examples of mind scientists deciding to collaborate with artists or with philosophers. So you have psychiatrists giving mescaline to people like Walter Benjamin or Jean-Paul Sartre. There was a wonderful experiment that took place in London in the 1930s, where two psychiatrists who were investigating hallucinations decided to give mescaline to a bunch of surrealist artists, because they thought, well, you know, these people are going to be able to paint or draw their hallucinations. These are people who are used to, you know, externalizing the context of the subconscious mind. So an awful lot of what starts off as scientific engagement with mescaline goes off in strange and unpredictable directions.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Oh, I love it. I have to ask too about maybe some of the art involved with the physical book itself. The design of your book is very appealing. Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
Yeah, that was a delightful surprise for me. I think it's a great design. I mean, I gave a brief for the cover. I'd suggested it should be psychedelic, but not kind of psychedelic in that kind of op art 1960s way that we conventionally think of it. This is something kind of darker in tone, you know, colors emerging out of darkness. You know, there's a great motif that runs through the investigation of mescaline, which is about people closing their eyes in a darkened room and seeing these colors start to appear. So my visual references for this were abstract animators of the 30s, people like Oscar Fischinger. I don't know if you remember Fantasia, the Disney movie, opens with painful sequence, the sort of synesthesia of, you know, as the orchestra tunes up and these sort of images appear. So that was kind of what I had in mind. And I just gave that brief to my editor, who'd then turned up something absolutely perfect. I think it's also, you want something that kind of, in a way, has a look of kind of tribal art or Mexican art, like Huichol art, but also has that feeling of 20th century science to it as well. And I think it bridges those two just beautifully.
I'll just say very quickly that I had a few nightmares about Fantasia and walking brooms when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just have to say to listeners too that the cover just pops. It's very vibrant, and flipping through the book is a visual experience as well. So, look, it's obvious that you're contributing, I think, to important contemporary discussions right now as well in medical science. I mean, I'm in a school of pharmacy. And this is something that a lot of my colleagues and I are talking about, is the use of psychedelics in as viable therapeutics nowadays. And so who is it that needs to read this book? I mean, obviously you've written the book for many audiences, and it's very accessible and extremely informative. But who, if you had to pick, needs to read the book the most?
Yeah, I mean, this was another appealing thing about mescaline as a subject, is that mescaline is nowhere to be seen in the psychedelic renaissance. You know, it's the drug for which the term psychedelic was coined, but everybody is working with ketamine or psilocybin, LSD or MDMA. So I don't have to engage with that directly. I guess what I'm trying to do is to give a sense of the hinterland behind this and of the long history of people trying to co-opt mescaline for medicine, and particularly for psychotherapy, and the it's a history that goes way back to the beginning of the 20th century. I think much earlier than people realize. And it's a history that's fascinating, but also problematic. I mean, in terms of pharmacy, I think, you can see from the very beginning how hard mescaline was to contain, because most drugs have predictable effects. Yes. You know, even psychoactive drugs, you know, Valium doesn't make kind of some people sort of sleepy and other people overexcited. You know, it does what it does. Yep. But mescaline, from the very beginning, it had an enormous number of different effects on different subjects. It was a very intense experience for people who were enjoying that experience. It was intensely enjoyable. For people who were not, it was terrifying and nightmarish. So I think before we kind of start to treat psychedelics just like another kind of item in the psychopharmacy, I think it's interesting to look at the wider story of its use, how tantalizing and fascinating it's been, but also how problematic, and how many of its most effective uses have been outside the clinical paradigm.
What I've found with talking with people who are maybe uninitiated in the history of psychedelics generally, sort of lump them all together. And I suppose what you've done is really nuanced the story of mescaline and shown that it's not at all the same as LSD. Is that fair to say?
It's surprising how, when you look at that time in the 1950s when LSD is coming in and replacing mescaline, and looking at the people who are comparing it, most people, you know, people like Aldous Huxley, who began with mescaline, then moved on to LSD and kind of went, oh yeah, this does pretty much the same thing. And people like, Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD. I guess when those are the only two substances that do anything like this, you know, then their commonalities are much more apparent. But of course, the huge difference is in dosage. Right. Mescaline is something that, you know, is active at doses of several hundred milligrams. LSD, it's micrograms. So I think that made it more appealing at that point to neuroscientists, because it was obvious that this must be acting on some very specific, if unknown, trigger mechanism.
So can we just pivot a little bit away from the book to Mike Jay's advice for younger writers and scholars? Can I ask a question, if I may, about as the author of over a dozen books, extremely prolific, what kind of advice you'd give to younger authors?
Yeah, I think I have found the history of drugs to be a very valuable subject to explore. It's not the only thing I've written about, but I've kind of being freelance, you know, people kind of commissions come back at me, you know, and something that's drugs are a perennially sexy and popular subject. So the reason I've ended up writing about them a lot is because people, I've become the go-to guy for this kind of thing. And what I find great about it is that it's treated as a specialism, as if I'm a specialist in this. But of course, I'm not. I'm not an academic. I'm really a generalist. And what I like about it, and what I find so rewarding about it, is it's a subject that enables you to cherry pick a lot of interesting material from different territories. So, there's ethnography and anthropology in here. There's the history of science. You know, there's the history of art and literature. There's neuroscience, of course. And I think that's a good way, you know, particularly if you're starting out, to find an original subject and an original voice, is to yoke together a couple of disciplines that haven't been explored together. And I think we're now reaching the point where, in terms of writing about psychedelics and drugs, there's kind of like a little, there's quite a culture around that, but I think I find that that culture kind of, it's a little bit of an echo chamber, and it's slightly insular because people treat drugs or psychedelics as if they're a subject in their own right. So I would say reach out from that and, you know, do a deep dive into one or another kind of specialism or aspect of history that you can attach this to, and bring new life to it, and get new facets of it to catch the light.
So what direction are you heading next? And I guess what I'm asking is, like, what kind of project are you turning to in the weeks and months ahead?
That's a very good question. I find as a writer at the level that I'm writing, it takes a while to tee up a new book. You know, I have a lot of shorter commissions, which are great. You know, essays and reviews. This kind of writing is fascinating. So you might see in the Wall Street Journal in the next couple of weeks a piece I've written about a new book about the history of lithium, which is fascinating. I mean, that's another. That's another drug that kind of spills out of the boundaries of medicine. I did not know, for example, I mean, we all know that Coca-Cola used to have cocaine in it, but I did not know, for example, that 7-Up used to have lithium in it, that it was a kind of, that there were these kind of calming sedative, tonics, and there's a, so what I tend to find is that, I get given these commissions, there are always like little stories that I'm researching myself and developing, and I proceed like that for a while, and then at some point, they coalesce into a new subject. But I'm not in any hurry to kind of rush into a new project straight away. It's a kind of nice point at the moment where I can continue to spin out elements of aspects of this book and open up to new material.
That's a great spot to be in. And your most recent book, Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic, was also a great read. And thanks so much for spending this time with me today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Luke. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
You too.